the intellectuality of Christianity, evidence for its validity. I realize we have two sessions, so I'm going to have to be brief in some of these areas. And this morning, I want to speak in the area of the Scriptures, because I just love it when somebody challenges me in the validity of the Scriptures, their accuracy, their authenticity, because it's one area that I've developed a fond love for in my research. There were three main areas that I needed to refute. Main areas was the resurrection, the deity of Christ that he claimed to be God, and the Scriptures. And those are the three that I really tore into as a non-Christian. And with all three of them, it was a mind-changing situation. And in our hour together here, I would like to share with you some of the things that I discovered as I studied the Scriptures. Often I'll be in a classroom, and someone I'll say to the professor, do you use the Bible in your course like it's a literature class? And usually the response is, no, I wouldn't waste my time. I said, no. I'll say to the professor, do you read the Bible? Nah, I don't even have it in my library. I'll be in a fraternity, and I'll say to a student, do you have a Bible? Yeah, it's on the top shelf of the other greats. Well, when I hear statements like this, like these, I pretty well figure I'm listening to uneducated individuals when it comes to the Scriptures. I mean, I can document in history that their analysis is uneducated. Let me show you why. First of all, the Bible is unique. You say, what do you mean unique? What do you mean by that? Webster would define it this way. Different from all others, no equal or like. Different from all others, no equal or like. Now, with that definition, you can actually hold the Scriptures in your hand and say it is different from all other books. Now you say, well, in what way is it different and unique? No, there's no other likeness to it. First of all, in its continuity, the way it was put together. See, what do you mean by continuity? Uniqueness and continuity is this. Here was a book written over a period of 1,500 years, the Old and New Testament. Over 40 generations. Not only 40 generations, but 40 plus authors participated in it, from every walk of life. Fishermen, peasants, military generals, scholars, doctors, historians, priests, rabbis, sheep herders, prime ministers, cupbearers, every walk of life. Not only every walk of life, but they wrote in different places. Some wrote in prison, in jail, in the synagogue, on the beach, in a military campaign. Not only different places, but the Bible was composed by people writing from different moods. Some wrote from the heights of joy. Others wrote from the depths of sorrow. Not only different moods, but they wrote at different times. Some wrote in the times of war. Others wrote in the times of peace. Not only different times, but they wrote in three continents. A lot of people don't realize that. Africa, Asia, and Europe. Not only did they write in three different continents, they wrote in three different languages. Most of the Old Testament is in Hebrew. Portions of it, like Daniel 2 to 7, is in Aramaic. You say, why would they do that? For this reason. Many of the portions that were directly related to the non-Hebrew and to, quote, the heathen, that portion was put into the language, the lingua franca of that day. So the Gentile or the heathen could understand it. And that was Aramaic. Like Daniel 2 to 8 is directed to that individual. The New Testament in Koine Greek. Three different languages. And they not only wrote in three different languages. They wrote on hundreds of controversial subjects. With absolute harmony from beginning to end. You say, well, what's a controversial subject? A controversial subject is where you would make a statement and you'd have three or four opinions. For example, if I make the statement that the Dallas Cowboys are the finest team in all the world, that'd be controversial. Sometimes there's a basis for it, other times there's not for the controversy. But if I made this statement, my wife is beautiful, that's not controversial. That's just a tremendous grasp of the obvious. Now, the authors of the scriptures wrote on hundreds of controversial subjects with absolute harmony from beginning to end of one unfolding story from Genesis to Revelation of God's redemption of humanity through the Messiah. Paradise lost of Genesis is paradise regained of Revelation. You cannot understand the book of Revelation without understanding Ezekiel. You can't understand Ezekiel without understanding Corinthians. You can't understand Corinthians without understanding Isaiah. You can't understand Isaiah without understanding Matthew. You can't understand Matthew without understanding Daniel. You can't understand Daniel without understanding... It's all interwoven of one continuous story in harmony without conflict. You say, so what? I'll tell you so what. Here was a person in one continent, one society, one language, one walk of life, one mood, writing about a controversial subject. Here was another person at the same time, but a different continent, different language, different culture, different society, different mood, different walk of life, writing about that same controversial subject. And when the two are brought together, there's absolute harmony. I was in the home of a friend of mine, Dick Day, and a representative of the great books of the Western world had made an appointment with us because they knew that we lecture in universities and thought we could give them leads or contacts for salespeople in the universities for the great books of the Western world. Well, their representative came to sell us on giving them contacts. And a man very knowledgeable in books from their head office. And he went and laid out the long sheet of paper. It's about twice this long. It has the backs of all the books of the great books of the Western world and everything. And he spent 5 minutes telling us about the great book series. And we spent an hour and a half telling about the greatest book. When we finished, we challenged him to do this. To take those books before him. Not over 40 generations, all from one generation. Not 40 plus authors like the scriptures, only 10 authors from one walk of life, in one mood, one language, writing on one controversial subject. Just one controversial subject. I said, would they agree? And I remember he looked at us and looked at the great books and looked back and he said, no. I said, what would you have? And he said, a conglomeration. 2 days later, he committed his life to Jesus. Because he realized the absolute uniqueness in continuity. Now, this doesn't mean the Bible's true. But it shows any intelligent individual seeking truth would consider a book that has that uniqueness. The Bible's also unique in its circulation. Ladies, the number one book in all of history with no close second is the Bible. In fact, two of the next five in the all-time list are about the Bible, one being Pilgrim's Progress. About the Bible. And the sixth one is about the Bible. So three of the next six are about the Bible. On the all-time selling list in all the world. The printing press did not even come out till about 1500. By 1830, just with the publishing houses, that's not all Bible societies. Just the Bible society. That's not including the publishing houses or anything in the world. Just the Bible societies in the world had produced 1 billion copies of the scriptures or portions thereof and distributed. Last year it was 200 million. Last year. It is unique in its circulation. Now this doesn't mean it's true. But anyone searching truth would certainly, if they were open-minded, consider a book that had that qualification. The Bible is not only the number one book in circulation, but the Bible is unique in its translation. The first major book translated was the Hebrew Old Testament called the Septuagint. I referenced to it last night. It was initiated about 250 years before Christ. It is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. And Septuagint comes from the Greek 70, and it's called the 70 version. And the tradition was that 70 men in 70 days in 70 separate rooms translated the Hebrew Old Testament. Now, that's not what happened, but it's sort of a tradition that grew up around it, so they called it the Septuagint version. But the first major book ever translated was the Bible. The Encyclopedia Britannica said that between 1960 and 1970, there was an average of 3,000 people a day translating the scriptures. I mean, you know how unique that is? If a great book in history had 30 people working on its translation, it'd be unbelievable. Over 3,000 a day on the scriptures. Right now, it's been translated into 1,670 some languages and dialects. Right now, the Bible has been translated into the languages of 95% of the people in the world. The languages that remain are the languages spoken by only 5% of the people in the world. 200 million people. A lot of people don't realize that. Every 9 days, the New Testament is started in a new language somewhere in the world. Every 9 days. Every 7 days, a New Testament in a new language comes off the press. Every 7 days. This never happened in history. You almost think the Lord's about ready to come back. But that is unique. There's no close second in its translation. Now, that doesn't mean it's true. But it lays a good basis for considering the message of a book that has that qualification. The Bible is unique in its survival through criticism. See, now what do you mean it's survival through criticism? First of all, it's survival through criticism in time. Now this is what I'm bringing out here. In time, literature of antiquity was written on material that would perish. In chapter, I think it's chapter 2 of Evidence, I have an entire chapter on how literature of history was prepared, what the different types of material they used and everything. And I did that for several reasons. So once you study it, then when you hear those terms or see them, you'll be able to understand it more. And second, you have a greater appreciation of the scriptures. Almost every single innovation in history to do with literature was motivated by the Bible. It's amazing. All new types of inks, quills, pens, paper, everything had to do with the scriptures. Even being the Bible was the first one ever put into book form. The motivation was the scriptures for almost every innovation. I mean, let me tell you, when I hear some of these people around the country knocking the scriptures, and when you look back and think the contribution of those motivated by the scriptures just in literature is unparalleled with any other book in history. Survival. Now, most of it was written on papyrus. Papyrus was a material taken from the papyri reed grown near the Nile in Egypt. Now, the problem was this material would rot away. So then they'd have to recopy it, and then it would rot away and recopy and recopy. In its survival through time is how many manuscripts. Now, manuscript, by definition, is a handwritten copy over against a printed copy before the printing press, when everything had to be done by hand. How many manuscripts do we have? When I came out with Evidence Demands Verdict in 1973, I was able to document 14,000 manuscripts of the New Testament. With a new updated version, it's been out several months now, I was able to, through new archaeological discoveries, document 24,633 manuscripts just of the New Testament. Is there any lady here that knows the number two book in all of history in manuscript authority? The number two book in survival and authority of manuscripts in all of history. Of course, the Bible is number one. What's the number two? Anyone here want to take a... You did? That's okay. What is it? The Iliad. Well, you know, since 1973, in all the universities I've been in, literature classes, the only person that's ever known as those that read Evidence. That's an indictment on our education system in many ways. The only one. How many manuscripts, ma'am? Take a stab. 643 manuscripts. Number two in all of history. The New Testament alone is 24,633. The Iliad by Homer is number two in all of history with 643 manuscripts. I mean, men and women. Ladies. Men. There's no close second. No close second. Survival, it is unique in its survival through time. It is unique in its survival through criticism. Negative criticism. That it's not authentic. That it's a fraud. It's just myth. It's legend. Let me show you what I mean. This is the area. If I had 5 hours just talking the Old Testament, I'd talk in this area. Survival through criticism. For years, the joke was in universities, have you found the Hittites? A lot of people found termites, but they never found the Hittites. In the Old Testament, it was a powerful group of people in relationship with the Jews, other nations, but apart from the Old Testament, no trace. No trace. Secular literature, archaeological discoveries, everything. Nothing. So for years, it was all taught the Hittites were a myth. And it was just thought up by the Jews to use in propaganda and everything. And they used to literally mock the Christian scholars. Like at Harvard, I read accounts where they'd mock the Christian scholars there and say, hey, you found the Hittites yet? And it was a common joke to put down the Christian scholar. Yes, they have. You can now go to Harvard, I mean the very place where they mocked, and study the Hittite language. In fact, this year, a Hittite dictionary is coming out. But the interesting thing is, God has a sense of humor. They not only found one Hittite, they have now found three different types of Hittites. One would have been enough. But I think the Lord says, let's have a good time and round it off to three. They mocked in the scriptures where it talks about the giants in the land, you know, 12 feet tall and everything. People said, come on, they don't have people like that today. Think what it'd do to basketball. And so they've always mocked it. Till not long ago, guess what they've discovered going back and dating to that time? Beds 14 feet long. And all of a sudden they say, uh-oh. Beds 14 feet long in that part of the world. Then they have, the Middle East, around the, a lot of it's around the palaces of Solomon. Yeah. But it's going back further than Solomon in date. Yeah. But I hope to document all this soon. I've got a lot of it now in the updated versions. And hope to write a book and do a film just on it. In fact, my desire is to take, I just love to take a tour to Israel for about 2 weeks and tour Israel. Of course, all the sites everybody sees, but as you go, bring up things they discovered there and show them that verified the scriptures all through Israel. I think it'd make an unbelievable tour. I think it'd be a fun one to take non-believers to, everything. Lois, let's go. You sing and I'll speak. You can even bring Arch and I'll bring my wife. And we'll let them just trail along. But they had, for years, there's been a theory around hypothesis called the documentary hypothesis. And some of you are shaking your heads and know what it is. It teaches that Moses could not have written the first five books of the Bible. Moses lived 1400 B.C. First five books, not Matthew, Mark, Luke, starting with Genesis, Matthew, Mark, Luke. No. The first five books of the Bible is called the Pentateuch. And Moses said he wrote it. Jesus said he wrote it. The New Testament said he wrote it. The apostles said he wrote it. The Jewish scholars said he wrote it. The Jewish historian said he wrote it. The Old Testament said he wrote it. Everything. Higher scholarship today said he could never have written it. They said it was not put together until 1,000 years after Moses, about 400 to 500 B.C. in the Persian period. And they said it was put together from various sources. J source, E source, P source, D source. And the way we got those is when you read Genesis, you have different segments referring to God with different names. Jehovah, well, Jehovah is really a wrong translation, should be Yahweh. But it got translated Jehovah, and I'll tell you why later, last part of my talk this morning. But Jehovah, J, E for the reference to God, Elohim. and D for Deuteronomy, E represented the priestly documents. And they said these were different documents. Of course, no one's ever seen the documents. You talk about faith. But these documents weren't until about 1,000 years after the time of Moses. And all the oral tradition was taken and put together in writing about 400 B.C. and put together by various people into the Pentateuch. Now, this is taught and accepted. But it's going through some problems right now. And one of the reasons they taught it, they said that 3,500 years ago when Moses lived, there wasn't any writing. I mean, this was documented. There was no writing. There was no alphabet. So how in the world could Moses write the first five books of the Bible? And in more evidence, I've documented this in the secular textbooks. I mean, the textbooks used in our seminary, there was no writing. Well, recently, it was a few years ago, about 1971-72, two professors, Dr. Pettinato and Dr. Mattai, from the University of Rome, started to excavate a tell. Now, a tell is not a gossip column. A tell is a mound of dirt that has, over the years, covered up in ancient ruins. And it was 30 miles south of the city of Aleppo in northern Syria. They excavated it, and they didn't know what they were going to find. And they came to the end of a corridor, and they figured that was it. They went to the wall, and they stopped. Then for 10 years, they dug around and found nothing. This was 1965. They dug around for 10 years, found nothing except a statue. And on this little statue, on the torso, it had written a thing about the king, Ibit-Lim, presenting a basin to the goddess Ishtar, who reigns supreme in Ebla. And all of a sudden they said, Ebla? And all of a sudden they realized they discovered the kingdom of Ebla. Now, in other archaeological discoveries, there had been references to it, but always in sort of a mythical way. Plus, you know how the scholars are. I mean, they give you an outline of history, and there's nothing can fit in between. They said there's absolutely no room for another kingdom in history. No way. I mean, it just couldn't be. And so they totally, because of their presupposition, their assumption that their chronology of history was correct, that there was no room for another kingdom, and no reference in all archaeology and literature and everything to any other kingdom, there never could be. Well, for 10 years they dug around. They went back to where they had stopped at the end of that quarter, and they dug 36 inches further. Now, can you imagine out in the tules for 10 years digging and nothing? 36 inches further they dug and made the greatest 3rd millennium B.C. discovery that will probably ever be made. 15,000 tablets. And these tablets are not even the royal library. It's where they went to the library, took them out and copied them and take them back. We do that. We go to the library, take a book out, plagiarize it, and put it back. Now, in our educational system, if you quote one person, you're plagiarizing. If you quote many, you're a scholar. And they found 15,000 tablets. And they discovered that Ebla, E-B-L-A, E-B-L-A. There's a section on it in Evidence That Demands a Verdict in the revised, the one I have here. Yeah. And also in the 8-tape series, I don't know if there's any, there's an 8-tape series at 16 hours and just stuff like this. And in there I have a whole hour, an hour and a half just on this. On there. It was founded around 2450 B.C., destroyed 2250 B.C. by the Assyrians. At its height, it had 260,000 within just the city. It was one of the most powerful kingdoms in all of history. It's so funny. They had to throw all their textbooks right out the window, all their assumptions and everything because of what they discovered here. It rivaled any kingdom in history. Ebla did. And it's interesting. Every road in the kingdom, all roads lead to Rome, that started in Ebla. All the roads not only led to Ebla in the kingdom, it led right smack to the front door of the king's palace. They had a palace for the king, for the servants also had their own palace. The entire city was broken up into municipal sections and everything. They had 4,000 people that ran everything and broken down into people under them. The king could not have walls around his palace. Now, this is more modern than we are today. They got a fence around the White House. But the king could not have a wall around the palace because Eblah believed that the king was directly responsible to the people and had to be accessible by the people. I mean, this is revolutionary in history. And in here they found a new language, Eblite. Now, it usually takes you years to understand a new language. I mean, literally years, 15 years sometimes. Well, they understood it within weeks. Because the Eblite language, where they found it, had, I think it was 1,000 tablets containing over 3,000 words of Eblite with its equivalent in the Syro-Canaanite language, which we understand. Akkadian. And all of a sudden, you had 1,000 tablets that gave you the entire key to the language. And so just overnight, they understood everything. And this goes back almost 4,500 years, the oldest kingdom ever discovered, 1,000 years before Moses in the same part of the world. Two distinct languages. I mean, they found it on toilet articles, junior high primers, everything. And all of a sudden the critics had to say, there was language. There were at least two distinct ones with alphabet, everything, 1,000 years before Moses. Then another reason why they said Moses could not have written the first five books of the Bible is that the different names for God indicated different sources for God. Well, in one tablet, they found five different names from God for God from the same source. And all of a sudden they had to say, well, that assumption goes out the window. It's like today. I mean, it's the same thing. I'll write one page and I'll refer to God as Father, as Yahweh, in different terms. Creator, it's the same way. And then they said that Genesis 14 is myth. This has always been taught. In Genesis 14, you have five cities of the plains, including Sodom and Gomorrah. And apart from there, you have no reference in history to these five cities. Secular history, archaeological discoveries, nothing. And so they said, look, if there were powerful cities like that, and the military campaigns talked about between them, there had to be references in other history. That's logical, because we've always had that, the argument from silence, which is dangerous. So they taught Genesis 14 was myth. It's kind of interesting. Archaeology is a new science. It hasn't been around that long. It's only since World War I. And they really never got money from foundations and things after World War II. And so this is why there's such an avalanche of archaeological discoveries that's changing historical perspective and biblical perspective. And they used to teach all of Genesis was myth. Then archaeology came along and confirmed the patriarchal period. So they said the first 40 chapters are myth. Archaeology came along and said first 30 chapters are myth. Archaeology came along and then about 10 years ago they started saying, well, the first 20 chapters are myth. And now they've taken it all the way back to Genesis 14. Next thing you know, they'll find the fig leaf. No. I even have documented in more evidence quotes by some of the great scholars mocking Genesis 14, saying it was all myth. It was legend developed by the Jews to counteract their enemies and put the Jews in a good light. And this is totally accepted, taught to our children in our literature classes and universities, everything. In one tablet in the Eblah discovery, it was in a package of tablets of economic relationships of Eblah with various countries and cities and all. The five cities of the plains were mentioned, including Sodom and Gomorrah. And all of a sudden, even Noel Friedman at university must have broken his heart. He had to come out and say to the gathering of scholars, saying, history has now confirmed that Genesis 14 is fact. I mean, it's thrilling. It's survival through criticism is amazing. This is why when I go to Germany and lecture in France, they bring up issues I can't answer. All I do is just smile and say, men, let's wait around. Time is on my side. Nelson Glick, the great Jewish scholar, the former president of Hebrew University in Cincinnati. And he said not one single archaeological discovery has ever controverted the scriptures. Not one. Almost every time a spade goes into the ground, a critic is buried. And I'm serious, ladies. It's amazing what they're finding. I mean, now they just, in the last several months, they've made some unbelievable discoveries in Jerusalem that's redating the entire Iron Period. And now it's falling right in with the chronology, and these were secular people, it's falling right in the chronology of the Old Testament. Where they always said, because secular historians say this was the chronology, the Bible differs with it, the Bible's out of it. Well, now they have to redate the entire Iron Period, everything, and it's coinciding right directly with the Scriptures. Survival through criticism. Survival, it's unique, and it's survival through persecution. There's probably never been a book that's been persecuted more and people have tried to eradicate from the face of the earth than the Scriptures. In AD 303, Diocletian, the Roman emperor, gave his famous edict to have every Bible in the world destroyed. Diocletian. The irony, 25 years later, the next emperor, Constantine, gave his famous edict to the historian Eusebius to produce 50 perfect copies of the Scriptures for the royal library at the government's expense. I mean, history's full of that, where they say one thing, then they turn around and produce perfect copies. Voltaire. Voltaire was a Frenchman who despised Christianity. He despised Christians. He wanted to do everything in his lifetime to eradicate Christianity. He boasted before he died that within 100 years of his lifetime, Christianity would pass off the face of the earth and the Scriptures would be eradicated. What happened in history? Well, Voltaire became extinct. Dig him up, it might be worse. But 50 years after Voltaire, it's kind of like the Beatles made their boasts more popular than Jesus. And that sure went down fast. 50 years after Voltaire made that boast, the Geneva Bible Society moved into his former home and used his former printing presses to produce thousands upon thousands of copies of the Scriptures. And history's full of it. It's survival through persecution. You say, well, wait a minute, Josh, all right. It's unique, that's cute, but look, the Bible's a religious book. I mean, especially a religious book you can't trust. But it was written 2,000 years ago. You can't trust what it says. Well, all the years of copying, the discrepancies and everything, you can't trust what it says. Well, I'm not quite sure about that. I was in a major university in this country, very prestigious history department. And I was invited as a guest lecturer. It's interesting. So often they do that. It's a setup, and which I enjoy. And so I went in. The head of the history department was also the professor of the class. And in a literature class or a history class, I almost always make several statements about the Bible. First statement is that I believe there's more evidence for the historical reliability of the New Testament than any 10 pieces of classical literature combined. Not any one piece, but any 10 combined. Second, I say that if anyone says the New Testament is not historically reliable, then they will have to throw out all literature of antiquity or use a double standard. I made that statement. The head of the history department sat over in a corner chair like you are. It seems like it was 250 students there. And he just started snickering right while I was speaking. He just went, oh, come on. Oh, bad. Oh, no. That's right while I was speaking. So I turned around and I said, tell me, sir, why are you snickering? Well, what would you do? And he stood up and he addressed the class. He said, men and women, the nerve, the audacity, that a guest lecturer in this department would make a statement the New Testament is reliable. Well, that's ridiculous. Of course, all the students were going like this. We pay to be parroted. And so I love it when somebody says something like that. Because in 580 universities, I've never had a positive answer to this question. I said, sir, and I rubbed it in love and graciousness. I said, as a man with two PhDs, one from Harvard and one from Germany, I said, as an historian, the professor of this class, the head of the history department of this great university, I said, "Sir, what are the tests that you use to apply to any piece of literature of history to determine its historical accuracy and reliability?" Do you know he didn't have any? In 58 countries, 580 universities, I've never run into anyone yet that did. I said, "Sir, I have some tests. And I'm not being theological biased. It's by a non-Christian military historian, Dr. C. Saunders, his book, Introduction into Research in English Literary History. He gives three tests. One is the bibliographical test." And a student spoke up and said, "I knew you'd bring the Bible in." You can't win. I said, "Bibliographical test, internal evidence and external evidence test." Let me just briefly touch on these. The bibliographical test asks two questions about the manuscripts. One is, how many do we have, which we looked at. The more manuscripts you have, the easier it is to recreate the original, called the autograph, or the autograph, some people call it. Second, what is the time span from the original copy, which is rotted away, to the closest copy? In other words, you copy the original, and then you make generation number one manuscript. Then generation number one, after years, starts to rot away. You make generation number two from that. Generation two starts to rot away. You make generation number three. Well, how many generations away from the original are you? How far? How many years? The further away, the greater opportunity for errors or inaccuracy. The closer, the less possibility, and the easier to reconstruct the original. Let's look at, first of all, just the numbers. Caesar and the Gallic Wars. In fact, how many of you here do not believe Caesar fought the Gallic Wars? Let me see your hand. How many of you do not believe Caesar fought the Gallic Wars? Do you know he's the only one who wrote about it? I'm sure others did, but all their works have been lost in history. The only way we know Caesar fought the Gallic Wars is he's the only one that wrote about them. But we're taught in universities everything else from that one source, all the details of Caesar and the Gallic Wars, everything. But he's the only one that wrote about it that ever survived. Up until several years ago, they found some archives in Rome, in Italy, in references to Caesar and the Gallic Wars. The Caesar and the Gallic Wars, there's only 10 manuscripts. Only 10. Everything else has been lost. Everything that we know about Caesar and the Gallic Wars comes from one of 10 manuscripts. Of Tacitus, a second century Roman historian, less than 20 manuscripts have ever survived in history. Thucydides, many people consider one of the most accurate historians of history, 8 manuscripts. Herodotus, a 5th century BC Greek historian, 8 manuscripts. Sophocles, 100. Aristotle in his Poetics is now up to 49. For a while it was only 37. Now they've discovered 12 more, 49 manuscripts. Aristophanes, about 30. As I said earlier, just the New Testament, we got 24,633. It's not even a comparison. And then the bibliographical test of literature of history is the time. Caesar and the Gallic Wars, and the time Caesar wrote to the closest manuscript is 1,000 years. In other words, all the generations in between have been lost or destroyed. Of Tacitus, over 1,000 years. Of Thucydides, 1,300 years. Herodotus, 1,300 years. Aristotle wrote his Poetics around 343 BC. Closest manuscript is 1100 AD. 1,400 years. But they even use Aristotle in the law courts today in his dictums on innocency. Of the New Testament, we go back within 100 years. See, a lot of people don't realize that. We go back with the John Ryland papyri. Papyri, because it was written on papyrus. So that's the identification thing. John Ryland papyri, 125 AD. The Chester Beatty papyri, 155 AD. The papyri Bodmer II, 200 AD. The Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, Alexandrus, 350 to 400 to 450 AD. You say, what are those things? Well, they're various portions of the scriptures, some very tiny and some complete scriptures. In chapter 4 of evidence, I list what they are, where they are, what they contain, their significance. And not only those, but many others. In fact, when they discovered the John Ryland papyri, one scholar wrote, who was very negative on the scriptures, he said, everything that I've taught in universities for 30 years went right out the window. Because they taught that the New Testament was a second century document. And the papyri they found took it all the way back to the first century. In the bibliographical tests, it stands supreme. In fact, you can take every Bible in the world and destroy it. Take every manuscript and burn it. And within 150 to 250 years of Jesus Christ, I can reconstruct all but 11 verses in the entire New Testament without any Bibles, no manuscripts, anything. You say, no, wait a minute. That's impossible. No, it isn't. First brought to my attention by the Encyclopedia Britannica. You ever, oh boy, every time I mention Encyclopedia Britannica, a thorn in the flesh, it is by far the greatest. It's always been my dream to have an up-to-date version of Encyclopedia Britannica. I mean, it is fabulous for research, everything. So I'd saved up my money, and I figured, well, I can get a used one, somebody, a stress sale. I got to get out of it and sell something, get some money. So I looked in the papers for about a year, and I found this one, San Bernardino Encyclopedia Britannica, so-and-so, et cetera, deluxe bindings. I was so excited. I told my wife, went down, got the money out of the bank, went over. It was a serviceman, gave him the money, boxed up, took it home, put it in the shelf. Gorgeous, beautiful. I was boasting about it to my wife. I've got the Encyclopedia Britannica. And not quite the micro or something encyclopedia. Microsoft. What?
The one they put on microchips.
No, it's a new one out. Yeah, it's a new one. I can't think of what it is. But anyway, had it up there. One day I was boasting to someone. I looked up, and it wasn't the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Oh.
It was the Encyclopedia International. You talk about your heart dropping. boy, anyway. So the Encyclopedia International says, no. But this was first brought to my attention by the Britannica. In fact, in many areas, it's the only encyclopedia that can be quoted in the court of law without being verified as Encyclopedia Britannica. Others can be quoted, but you have to back it up and verify it. And that's the scholarship of that. I've led people to Christ, reading about Jesus and the Apostle Paul and everything in the Encyclopedia Britannica. I got a chapter on it, more than a carpenter, a fellow with the Apostle Paul. I led to Christ in Encyclopedia Britannica. But there pointed out that the early Christian scholars and church fathers, when they would write out a talk and articles and things, way back then, they would copy the manuscripts. Just like I do today when I write out my talks. I copy, I write in Matthew 24, something like this, I write it out. Well, you can take their works that have survived. And when I first came out with evidence, I was able to document 36,000 quotations of the New Testament. Now with further research and a new one out, new evidence, I'm able to document 89,000 quotations of just the New Testament and the Church Fathers and reconstruct all but 11 verses. I mean, there's no other book in history you can do that with. It survives in its time in history. Then the internal evidence tests is two issues there. One, they use the dictum of Aristotle that, it's what we use in our courts of law today, that a person is innocent until proven guilty. In other words, any manuscript, any book, is to be taken at face value until proven that it shouldn't be. Innocent until proven guilty. The second question is, it asks about the closeness of those reporting the event to the event itself. Historically, or in other words, chronologically and geographically. The closer you are to the event you're reporting, both geographically and chronologically, usually the more accuracy of the report is more accurate. Now let me just touch on that in the internal evidence test here in two areas that so many people overlook. First of all, the writers of the New Testament wrote as eyewitnesses or recorded eyewitness accounts. They wrote as eyewitnesses or recorded eyewitness accounts. You can't get any closer. For example, John said in 1 John, he said, what our eyes have seen and ears have heard and our hands have handled, we declare unto you. You can't get much more existential in the sense of being there. Luke starts out his gospel saying that he had studied everything carefully from the beginning, from those who were eyewitnesses, so he could record the truth, the exact truth of what had been taught. In Acts 1, it says he appeared unto his disciples over a period of 40 days with many convincing proofs. And that phrase, convincing proofs, was a phrase from the law courts of that day of overwhelming evidence, compelling evidence. The in John 20, verses 30 and 31, said, many other things Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, talking about the signs to confirm he was the Messiah, that are not even recorded. He said, many other things Jesus did in the presence of his disciples to confirm his deity. They wrote as eyewitnesses. But they not only wrote as eyewitnesses. Let me check on another verse here. My mind's not running full. Till here. 2 Peter 1:16. Peter said, we did not follow a cleverly devised tale. See, they knew the difference between cleverly devised tales and legends and myth and history. Now, this the gall of so many of our educators today. They sit in the classroom, they look back at the apostles, the writers of the New Testament, historians of that day as being ignorant and not knowing the difference between myth and legend. That is so far from the truth. Let me tell you, I find greater scholarship in history than I do today. Much greater, because our thrust today in the universities is not, we do not have a thirst for knowledge or truth. We have a thirst for that which is relevant. We're not seeking after that which is true. We're seeking after that which is relevant, whether it's true or not. And it's frustrating to lecture in that context in the universities, because you have no objective of basis for truth anymore. And they said, look, we did not follow cleverly devised tales and we made known to you the power and coming of the Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of it. Now, any lawyer, and there's several of you ladies that are lawyers, you know the value of eyewitness accounts. Second, and this is what a lot of people overlook, they not only wrote as eyewitnesses, but they appealed to the knowledge of the readers and listeners concerning the evidence of which they spoke. You say, what do you mean? When they wrote and spoke, they not only said, look, we saw these things, but in the presence of the most adverse critics, they'd say, you did too. They'd throw the argument right back on their lap. Now, I know one thing. When I go into a debate and I appeal to the knowledge of my opponent about something, I better be accurate or it's going to be shoved right back down my throat. And this is what they did all. They threw it. I said, look, you saw it. Here was Paul brought before the king. And he gives a defense for Christianity. And Paul says, and the king says, Paul, you're great learning. Well, they knew he had great learning. I mean, he studied under Gamaliel, which was like studying at 3 Harvards or 2 UDs. And said, your great learning is driving you mad. Paul said, I'm not out of my mind. Most excellent Festus. I like that. Most excellent Festus. But I utter words of sober truth. And the phrase there, sober truth, means of truth and rationale. And then he does this. He says, I speak to the king with confidence, for none of this has escaped his notice. And he threw that. He said, look, everything I've told you, you know about it. Not only do I know, you do too. King said, you better be careful. You're going to persuade me to become a Christian. Here was Peter in Acts 2:22 speaking before the Jewish crowds. And he said, men of Israel, Jesus of Nazarene, a man attested not only to us, to you, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs. Now let me tell you, if that crowd had not seen those miracles, wonders and signs, Peter had been lucky to get out of there alive. Which you yourselves know. He appealed to their knowledge concerning the facts of which he spoke. And that, men and women, when I look at any piece of literature in history or anyone speaking on something, the real key to truth is, this is called cross-examination in a court of law. In other words, you can cross-examine. You can question everything because you have the knowledge also of it. And so here you have cross-examination in history. because you constantly had the most hostile eyewitnesses there. Where if they dared to have departed, there were those there that would immediately have corrected them as vocal as they were in history. And that's one of the greatest tests for any piece of literature. Was it written at a time where there were people there that if it was false, it could be exposed? In other words, is it open to falsification? The whole message of the New Testament was, all they had to produce was the body of Jesus. The whole thing had been falsified. And then the external evidence tests, we don't have time to go into. It just says, is there other literature of that time that confirms the inner testimony of the literature that you're studying? In other words, of the Bible, is there literature around the Bible that confirms the inner testimony of the Bible? And there's many. There's many. In fact, there's one recently where it was one man quoting another man who was a direct disciple of the Apostle John. And they said that it was Papias. Papias was being quoted by, I think it was Irenaeus, around 300 AD. Papias was the teacher of Irenaeus. Papias was a disciple of the Apostle John, right back to the New Testament. So, Irenaeus recorded the works of Papias and some statements about the accuracy of the New Testament and everything that for years the scholars, historians have said, hey, wait a minute. Eusebius, they said Eusebius was the historian, doctored up the quotes of Papias. You know, changed them around, make them sound a little better. But now that's backfired because they found the works of Papias and found out that those unbelievable statements going back to the first century were true. And this is just some of the things. And just the New Testament. And maybe during the question and answer time, tomorrow morning I want to ask about the Old Testament. I could take maybe 10, 15 minutes on that during the question and answer time. But men and women. Men and women. Man and women, we don't have all the answers, but we do have a lot of them. And I've learned one thing. I have nothing to apologize for. Sometimes I have to say, I don't know. But if you know me, I very seldom say that twice because I love to research. And some of you were asking, and got 1 minute here. I've had so many questions about the different tapes and books, so what I think I'll do is just fill some of you in a group, and then you won't have to ask me individually. Evidence That Demands a Verdict was the first book I wrote in trying to refute Christianity when I couldn't. I spent 13 years documenting why. It's an anthology. I wanted to do it so people could use it. Over $25,000, which is probably the most expensive Christian book ever written and in research. But I wanted to go back everywhere I could to the original. Just one documentation cost me over $600 in 150 hours. And then when I found it was totally wrong the way people were using it. It was even better. I don't know why they misused it. And I found it in the Cyropedia by Xenophon. But that was the first book. The next, and it covers the entire spectrum of evidence for Christianity. More evidence, which is quite a bit deeper, is I had so many questions in the Old and New Testament. And anti-supernaturalism, which is a key issue today. So I wrote the second volume. And what I do, most of the part of the second volume, the first half of the book, is I'll take a statement out of a textbook where they said this in the Old Testament is myth. And then I simply go down and document what archaeology has discovered. For any of you that ever speak, it could make some powerful material for talking. Because it just gives what they absolutely said. It's legend. And then history found it to be historical. Then from there, I did more than a carpenter because I had so many businessmen and women saying, oh, I wish you could have been in this appointment with me. So I can't be a very many, so I'm going to write a book what I'd say if I were there. And it's the logical progression of the argument that I came to concerning my commitment to Christianity, about the person of Jesus Christ, the apostles, the oral testimony, written testimony, the resurrection, all tied together in a progressive argument that the average person can read in 2 hours. So you can read and see how average you are. But, then from there, I did Daniel in the Critic's Den. The number one book criticized in the scriptures is Daniel because of all the prophecy. It's the whole basis of prophecy. And Daniel purports to be written around 530 to 590 B.C. Well, all the critics said, no, it couldn't have been written after 160 B.C. because the prophecies weren't even fulfilled until then. So they said, God cannot intervene, prophecy cannot be true, therefore Daniel couldn't have written when it was. I mean, every textbook documents that. And when I started to write that book, I really believed that I wouldn't come up with the evidence to support the traditional dating of Daniel as authentic. Ladies, I don't know why in the world somebody hadn't published some of this stuff for. I told my wife, it's mind-blowing. The evidence, I mean, it's thrilling. And the appreciation I came out of the scriptures after doing Daniel and the critics did. Then I did givers, takers, and other kinds of lovers. Mainly because I wanted everybody in the world to have in sex, love, and marriage what my wife and I have. I wanted something that parents could read to help them in helping their children. I want something that kids could read to help them with their parents. And so I did Givers, Takers, and Other Kinds of Lovers, which has been made into a movie, number 3 in the country now, of 16mm films. And now is being released as a TV special hosted by Roger Staubach of, what's that, Cowboys. And then I had so many questions asked me over the years, so I took 300 questions that businessmen, professors, and students have asked me. And I listed out about 300, and then I narrowed it down to 100 of the tough ones, and then I picked out 63 of the most frequently asked ones, and I wrote answers to tough questions. And probably every question you've ever had is answered in there concerning the tough ones. And then I just came out last week with a book that's been my dream to write. It's just like some legislature maybe has a dream of passing one type of bill. Well, this was my bill. The heart of my talk is the resurrection. And I'm going to be talking on it tonight. It's the crux of Christianity. It's the crux of almost every doctrine of Christianity, historical proof of Christianity, everything. And I've done just thousands of hours in research on it. And I wanted to wait until I got enough writing under my belt to be able to do a quality job, because I'm not a good writer. I'm not. I have to work twice, probably three times as hard as most writers. But at least I got the drive and the determination. That makes up for a lot of shortcomings in other areas. And so I wanted to wait, and I got a lot of experience. And I put together, which almost everybody's read it now, said, Josh, it's by far your number one book. And I had two types, and it's interesting with this group, two types of people in mind when I wrote it. Lawyers and politicians. Lawyers, it's written straight from a legal perspective. Direct evidence, circumstantial evidence, eyewitness testimony, everything. Right, like a court. And just signed contracts where 5 films is being made of this book. And to be released, one will be a special Easter special set within a courtroom for a year from this Easter on television. And it's really neat. It looks like our desire is to have Arthur Hill and Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., in it. And so we already started 2 days ago in the manuscript, the script for it. And those are the books. Later, maybe tonight, I'll fill you in on the tapes and what they are. Let's pray. Father God, thank you for the scriptures. Thank you for walking by faith and intelligent faith in a fantastic book that you have given us. Thank you, Father, for its confirmation in history. And use what has been shared here briefly today to answer many questions, to build up a greater confidence, and give a greater desire to know you and love you and share you with others. Thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.